It's summer, and people are traveling.
First things first, let's buckle those belts. Insert the metal end into the buckle and pull the strap to tighten.
There is a moment for all of us when it hits us that we're really on vacation. For me, it's the safety instructions on the plane. If I'm listening to those, it means I've wrapped things up at work, gotten packed, made it to the airport, checked my bags, boarded the flight, and now all I have to do is sit there, relax, and be carried through the sky to my final destination.
The crew will now be coming around to do a final cabin check. After takeoff, we'll be back with more information. And if you need anything, don't hesitate to ask.
Record numbers of people are enjoying the beauty of travel. For work, for pleasure, getting on a plane and traveling hundreds of miles is no longer a big deal for most of us, which is great in so many ways. But more travel means bigger impact, environmental impact, economic impact, and just plain hassle, long lines, big crowds. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about whether there's any such thing as too much travel, and if so, what do we do about it? Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about how a rise in tourism has affected you, whether it's given you access to experiences you wouldn't trade or perhaps degraded a favorite place. 816-235-2888. My first guest is Martha Honey. She started the Center for Responsible Travel in 2003. Hi, Martha.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Nice to be with you, Gina.
You too. Well, what inspired you to start looking into the impact of our traveling practices in modern times?
Well, I think it was living. I was a journalist for many years, and I lived both in East Africa and Tanzania and then in Central America and Costa Rica. And while I was doing sort of day-to-day hard news stories, I was also watching out of the corner of my eye these wonderful places where I was living and was both an avid traveler myself, but also increasingly intrigued and I would say concerned about the impacts, the importance of the travel industry to developing countries, but also the impacts of travel, environmental, social, and economic on developing countries, with many countries actually not earning very much from tourism because many of the businesses were owned by multinationals, and also suffering a whole wide range of both environmental and social degradation and problems from tourism done badly.
How would you state sort of the main problems with too much travel? Like if you were to break them down into big umbrella categories.
Yes. So I think, you know, what we've seen, particularly over the last 2 years, is this new word over tourism enter our lexicon, enter our vocabulary, with lots of news stories and increasing talk about too many tourists or over tourism. I think the ingredients that make up over tourists are clearly, of course, large numbers of people traveling, but it's more complicated than that. And it's been fed by a number of trends that have been going on for the last number of years. One is, for instance, the growth of cruise tourism, the size, the number of ships, and the number of destinations that their ports of call that they're going to. The second is the tremendous growth of short-term rentals, Airbnb and other home rental programs in cities and other places. The growth of the middle class more broadly and the entry in large numbers of new traveling markets like China and in India as their middle class grows.
Can I stop you there and just
sure.
say how do we have that piece of the conversation without just sounding really horribly classist? I mean, the idea that that it was okay when just a few of us were doing, you know what
right.
I mean?
Right. No, I think we're in, you know, we're entering a new era and we are going to have to have some controls on travel, some regulation. And this is, you know, this is really the challenge for centrally for governments, but also for the travel industry, for local communities, et cetera, to be coming up with solutions. I think that the key is to come up with solutions which don't simply price people out of the market and control by making it, again, an exclusive prerogative of the wealthy. And so there are a number of tools that are being developed that can set some limits on the number of people visiting at a particular time, but do it in a more democratic way. For instance, a lottery system to get into parks or get into museums or or other attractions. Registration ahead of time, which again doesn't change the price, but requires people to register ahead of time, to plan their trips ahead of time. So there are tools like this, the controlling of the number of Airbnbs that are allowed in you know, fragile inner city areas or important historic centers.
Wait,
like
can you
Barcelona.
Explain the yeah. what is the problem with Airbnbs, what that contributes to?
Yes.
I guess it would be either cultural or economic degradation.
Right. So what has happened in a number of cities, and we're having these complaints come in and across a number of European cities, but also in the many U.S. cities, San Francisco, I was just in Hawaii, it's a problem there, and New York, et cetera, et cetera. And it is that large parts of urban cities are now being rental properties, have been given over from long-term rental to short-term rental. So that means that, one, there is oftentimes a housing shortage and a rising cost in long-term rentals for residents in the cities. And it also means that the nature of neighborhoods is changing. For instance, in places like Savannah, Georgia, or Charleston, South Carolina, where the inner city is really a very important historic icon, and is both important to their tourism, but also very, very important to the residents. And they are seeing that, you know, in some cases, over half of the properties are now being rented for short-term rentals. And so they're trying to get and it's changing the character.
Changing the character how?
Well, local residents don't know who their neighbors are anymore. It means that there may be, for instance, in Barcelona, there are reports of, you know, loud parties, drinking, behaviors that, you know, go on all night, that disrupt the flow, the ebb and flow of a residential neighborhood. And so there are a number of efforts in place to try to put some controls on it, limiting the numbers, saying that properties have to be the owner has to be on site, has to be living in the property that is rented, setting limits on the number of days that properties can be rented a year, and so on, to try to protect neighborhoods. I mean, we're seeing in some places like Barcelona and Venice that there's an outward flow of residents living there because it's become uninhabitable in terms of the cost of living and the shortage of housing.
So they're starting to become essentially like it's a resortification of actual places.
That's a great term. Yes, that's exactly right. That's right. And the character of the local city, both for the residents, but also really what was oftentimes the appeal that brought visitors to these places like Barcelona or Charleston, South Carolina, and so on. The local appeal is being eroded, and so they're no longer attractive either to residents or, frankly, increasingly to tourists.
A recent article about this in The Atlantic drew readers' attention to an incident in May when the staff at the Louvre walked out over the unmanageable crowds in front of the Mona Lisa.
Right. There are pictures of people standing at the Mona Lisa, not looking at the Mona Lisa, but with their back to the Mona Lisa, taking selfies. And this is, I think, another huge problem, the growth of what are called bucket lists of these must-see sites, which tend to be the same from one person, or largely the same. They're all the same. Destinations appear on
minor special.
Lists.
Just kidding.
Okay, I'm sure. but also the whole growth of selfies, which is, you know, instant gratification. You take a picture and you just want to have a picture of yourself at a destination, not really enjoying it. And so there's an effort in a number of places to encourage tourists to slow down, to stay longer, and to spend more time in a destination, to learn more about a destination, rather than zipping, you know, frenetic speed from one destination to another, ticking off a bucket list and taking selfies, which adds tremendously to congestion in places and creates a lack of enjoyment for anybody there.
With the environmental piece of it, we haven't even talked about the getting from point A to point B mm-hmm. aspect of travel and when it comes to the ethics, but can you talk about that piece of it a little bit?
Sure. I mean, clearly, you know, the travel industry is both contributing to and a victim of climate change. And airlines are one of the largest, probably the sector that is contributing most to greenhouse gas emissions. So there is an increasing effort both by the airlines themselves to create more fuel-efficient planes that take less fossil fuels, but also experimentation with creating non-fossil fuel planes. We're not there yet, but in 2016, the first solar-paneled plane, a one-person, one-seater, made it around the world. So there are experiments that are beginning to bear fruit, and I think that's one piece of it, and we need to keep the pressure on both the industry and on governments to provide incentives for the airline industry to become greener and to move away from its dependence on fossil fuels. I think there are things that as travelers we can do in the short run, which is when there's a choice of travel, particularly for short distances, to try to take the most sustainable, the greenest type of travel, a train, a bus, or whatever, rather than fly short distances. Try to avoid that. And
Would getting in a car and driving that same distance be better or worse?
Well, it partly depends on the kind of car, whether it's an electric or not. I think, that transportation systems that take more people, like a train or a bus, tend to be better than a car, particularly if it's, an electric bus or natural gas bus or whatever.
Can I ask you something? So when we talk about the distances people are traveling, the staycation for a while was a word that was gaining some currency. And I haven't heard that as much lately. I wonder if that's because we have emerged from the Great Recession. But also just thinking about the places that became popular here in Kansas and Missouri with the staycation.
Right.
We don't have tropical beaches or an Eiffel Tower or anything like that. We don't really have famous stuff, but we do have tourism, and a lot of it is people trying to escape urban settings, places like the prairie where you have these large expanses where there's just nothing but tall grass and big sky. The whole allure really is that ideally no one will be there. And even just from my experience, it seems like that is even not quite true anymore.
Yeah, I think that we are seeing, our national parks and, some specific ones, Acadia in Maine and Yellowstone and Arches and so on, are really, beginning to suffer from what we're calling over-tourism, and I think are moving towards reservation systems and so on to try to control the numbers. So, I think the reality is with so many people traveling, we are going to see, gradual imposition of controls on the numbers through registration systems and ticketing and so on.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We are opening up the phone lines right when we return. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Are your travel habits changing? Do you think they should be changing? How is all this tourism affecting your community, your industry, your life? 816-235-2888. We'll be getting a local perspective in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're talking now about tourism and the way we travel today. It's eye-opening to travel. It is empathy-building. It's fun to get out of your own little corner of the world. And it's also harmful when it's high impact, either culturally or environmentally. And now that lots of us are doing it, just more travel means bigger impact. So my guest so far has been Martha Honey of the Center for Responsible Travel. Hi again, Martha.
Hi there.
We're also going to take callers starting now at 816-235-2888. Let's start with Leanne calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Gina. This is Leanne, Michelle's mom. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. My ears really perked up when I heard the subject matter of your show today because I'm an intrepid traveler. I love to travel. For the last 18 years or so, I've traveled as much as I possibly can all over the world. And in the last several years, I've unfortunately seen some very negative effects of excessive tourism in certain places. And the two cities that I've recently visited in the last year and a half or so that really are showing the horrible effects of over-tourism are Venice, which your guest was speaking about previously, and Dubrovnik in Croatia. And both of those cities are being loved to death, and it's just awful.
And did you just say loved to death?
Loved to death, yes. When I was in Venice, I was aghast at the cruise ships that are just barging into this tiny, fragile city. And everyone who works, I don't know how many people live in Venice anymore, not very many, but the people who work in the hotels and so forth, they will tell you that the day trippers from the cruise ships are just destroying the city, and it's just tragic because it's such a fragile place anyway. And
but destroying it how?
Well, for one thing, the Airbnb issue is there. The influx of tourists every single day causes all the basic necessities of life to be too expensive for normal people to live there anymore. And the only real industry there is tourism. And so, as we all know, the folks who are the gondoliers and the folks who work behind the desk in the hotels, they're not making enough money to live a reasonable life in a place like Venice. And well, so,
can I ask you, what are your own thoughts about how, having observed this, how you might travel differently, or what's going on in your mind?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting that you asked that, because just last night I was out with a friend who is also a very avid traveler, and we were discussing this very topic about mainly the environmental impacts of our travel addiction. And so we decided that the next trip we take, and we're talking about next spring, is going to be by cargo ship. We're going to go overseas by cargo ship. And many cargo ships have accommodations for human cargo as well as the, whatever they're hauling across the ocean.
Fascinating idea. Thank you for the call, Leanne. I actually know someone who has traveled by cargo ship, and he tells me that at least when he did it in, I think, the 50s or 60s, they let him travel with his dogs that way, which is why he was doing it. Martha, what do you think of this call?
Well, I think this is great. First, just a couple of thoughts to add. One is that we have a new book out today, which this is a plug, but it's called Cruising in the Caribbean Cruise Tourism, Selling Sunshine. And it looks at the environmental, social, and economic impacts on ports of call of cruise tourism. And there are a whole host of problems that are highlighted, including some of the ones that Leanne mentioned. There's a chapter that is on Venice and Barcelona as sort of canaries in the coal mine for what the Caribbean is likely to suffer in terms of environmental issues in the future. One of the issues in Venice, for instance, in addition to the ones that Leanne mentioned, is that these enormous ships are coming up the narrow canals and the lagoon and are damaging the foundations of these historic buildings just by the vibrations that they're causing because of their size. So there is an attempt to move them, but it's been going on for many years without any resolution so far, but move them away from out of the canals and the lagoon and have another port of entry for Venice. But I think that there are some efforts underway. Dubrovnik, for instance, is now controlling the number of cruise passengers allowed into the historic city at a given time in an attempt to get a handle on the numbers. Another source that people may find of interest is we've put together at my organization, the Center for Responsible Travel, something called Responsible Travel Tips, which is free of charge, available on our website, which is www.responsibletravel.org. And it lists a number of things that travelers who are concerned about their environmental and social footprint can do, from looking for property, looking to support businesses that have been certified under some of the eco-certification programs, to, for instance, not taking pictures without asking people beforehand, being sensitive to local dress, et cetera, et cetera.
Martha, we're going to come back to tips. I want to bring in another guest now. We're going to speak with Marcia Rozelle. Marcia is with us from Manhattan, Kansas. She's with Visit Manhattan now. She used to work for Flint Hills Tourism. Hi, Marcia.
Hello. Well, hello. How are you?
Good. I'm curious about how tourism has changed in Kansas in the time you've been doing this line of work, and particularly in the Flint Hills and around the Flint Hills. What have you seen?
Sure. We have seen the importance of education of the Flint Hills, and I'm still with the Flint Hills Tourism Coalition. It's a consortium of 22 counties here in Kansas, and the importance of understanding the ecosystem of the Flint Hills so that people, when they are treading in there, that they understand what they're walking on. And so we've got a great facility here in Manhattan. It's called the Flint Hills Discovery Center that explains all the biology and the ecology of the Flint Hills. It's the last 4% of the tallgrass prairie.
So can you explain, have you seen a large increase in numbers of tourists in the Flint Hills?
We have. We've seen certainly that influx because people are trying to find that experiential travel, and a lot of times they're trying to get away from the busyness of their lives, and in the prairie, it's a place where you can catch your breath. There isn't a lot of big city experience. It's much more rural, small community experience, but we have seen that influx coming from the cities.
So, how does that impact local communities around you?
It's a tremendous, tourism is a tremendous impact in some of these smaller communities. It certainly is a way that they can grow with their sales tax dollars and keep the sustainability of their community alive by welcoming people from the outside.
Do you see that people are coming and finding the travel experiences themselves to be changed by the number of people who are interested? So that thing I mentioned before of that feeling of being alone in the open air with the tall grass and that big sky, are people sort of struggling to find where they can still get that? Or no?
Only in the sense of there's not a lot of structural attractions throughout the Flint Hills. A lot of them, they are the vistas, or it's the Tallgrass National Prairie Preserve where you can find out about things. So sometimes it's hard because there's a lot of private landowners in the Flint Hills, and you can't get access to that land or that experience. But there are nuggets, there are treasures to be found, and that's those places are getting visited.
So that's interesting. You're saying in a way that this is a place where not having access to being one of those people who could buy a house out there, that then you are in this position of, well, where do you go? It's
right.
A bunch of hills.
Right. Right. And there's certainly locations where you can get a room, stay the night, be in a historic property, and experience just that peacefulness of the prairie. But it's not a Disney World experience. It's not a high volume at a one location, except when it's a big event. So of course we have the Flint Hills Symphony that happens.
Or sometimes doesn't.
Right. That happens in June. And that brings in a lot of people for one night event. And so those are the experiences that people are flocking to.
Is creating an infrastructure for that one night experience a disruption locally?
Certainly that event in itself has a lot of moving pieces with it, but there are other locations in the Flint Hills that you can get into, and certainly what comes to mind is like the Elgin Hotel in Merriam, Kansas, and you can go there and rest and then get out into the Flint Hills on different trails that are in that community. But throughout the Flint Hills, you do have to go looking for those nuggets.
Do you find that the people visiting are coming from nearby, by and large, or from far away? Are you getting travelers from...
It really varies. We get a lot from the big cities close by, certainly Kansas City and Wichita. A lot of people come into the Flint Hills, but also from Europe. I mean, it is amazing the stories that come of travelers that are coming to find the peacefulness of the prairie and understand the ecosystem that the tall grass provides. And so there are people that are coming from further away to experience that.
Well, thank you, Marcia. Martha, is this also perhaps people trying to get out of those lines to see the Mona Lisa?
That may be some of it. I do think that that Marcia touched on a very important sort of sector, a segment of the traveling public, which is experiential tourism. And these are people who really want to, you know, enjoy authentic experiences. And I've found the same thing. I spend part of the summer in Maine and, you know, in some sometimes very remote areas, and suddenly a European will pop up there. And, you know, they've made their way there for exactly the same reasons that I and my family have, that it's peaceful, it's authentic, it just is, you know, it provides something to our souls that we need. And so I think that there are people going off the beaten paths to find this sort of deeper kind of spiritual sense that we all need to rejuvenate ourselves.
I want to talk now to George Frazier. He has found a way to hang on to the kind of travel adventure he likes to be on, even though the tourism industry doesn't just provide it for him. It doesn't necessarily even make it easy. He's the author of a book called The Last Wild Places of Kansas. Hi, George.
Hello.
What's your story, and why did you start seeking out what you call wild places in Kansas?
I'm from Overland Park, and that's sort of like being from Kansas, right? And when years back, I found myself traveling a lot to Colorado and Montana and California to look for sort of authentic wilderness experiences. And some people just one day wake up to where they are. And for me, it was because we had this seminal event where I lived in Lawrence, the plowing of the Elkins Prairie. And I saw
that.
What
is that?
So the Elkins Prairie was an 80-acre tract of never plowed prairie that was a beautiful prairie. And it's a long story, but the landowner decided to protect his land interests along this traffic way that we were building, that he would intentionally plow the prairie. And my takeaway when I saw that happening was this was a wild place, a place in Kansas that people cared strongly about, like the places I'd been traveling to, you know, out west. And I realized I didn't know anything about the wild places of Kansas, but that we had places like that. And so that kind of sent me on a journey of discovery around the state looking for these wild places.
Why is it hard to find a wild place or a quote-unquote authentic wild place?
So in Kansas, certainly the issue is private property. So in Kansas, 98% of our lands are privately owned. And so, you know, that sort of enforces a slow travel sort of a mentality that people have to take when they come to Kansas to look for these places. Because it's other than the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve, and then increasingly the Kansas River, we don't have well-developed wild places that people can visit. But that's changing. For example, many of the Nature Conservancy sites, like the new site New Jerusalem, southeast of Hayes, that they've done a careful multi-year project to plan how people are going to experience that site when they open it up.
How they're going to experience it without disrupting the nature of it, because it's the Nature Conservancy, right?
That's right. And, you know, I think my take on it is if you think of Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs, a lot of Kansans have been out there. Years back, you could go anywhere in Garden of the Gods, and it started to become loved to death. And so since then, they've replanned how people access Garden of the Gods, areas that are off limits to the public, areas that are not. And they've planned this, I believe, into the New Jerusalem site from the beginning.
That's super interesting.
The other thing I'll mention is that I think in Kansas, a lot of our traveling, and I think of the Flint Hills too as sort of as the cardinal destination in Kansas. Now, people coming from the cities, and I think of it as sort of as ecotourism plus beer, because there are so many communities, you know, around the Flint Hills that have opened microbreweries and restaurants and things, and those are a stop in the destination. So people go to the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve, and then they'll go to Emporia, to Radius or something. And increasingly, if you can't find access to a place, people will take you there. So we have an emergent tourism industry like the Prairie Earth Tours out of Emporia. They will take you to private ranches, and they have a whole string of places that are open to these sort of curated trips. And so that sort of brings together ecotourism and authenticity, people looking for authenticity, and then a way to meet people that are incredibly proud of their long heritages in the state, and then they have a way to share that with other people and, you know, make some money at the same time.
So with what we were just hearing about, that there is a rise in tourism in Kansas, a rise in your experience as a traveler, is that rise in high enough numbers that it is having an impact on the experience itself, or are we a long way away from that?
Yeah, I think we're still in the category of it would be a nice problem to have. The Kansas River, for example, I think is a good example. I think that people going onto the river to canoe is really exploding, but it's not to a level yet where we're even in the Missouri Ozarks.
Can you give me an example of a place in Kansas that you like to go, why you like it, and then what you do and don't do to be a good steward of that place?
I'll give you two examples.
Okay.
So one example that I would always send people to is the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve. And the reason is that people, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, the prairie, right? It's like they're used to going to the redwoods or something. And when they think about the prairie, it's sort of like a yawn thing. And the reason is, I think, because people haven't had a way to experience the prairie at scale. And so going to the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve is a way to experience that at scale. And so far, there's no aspect of environmental degradation there. Another example that's completely different is at Fort Leavenworth, there's the pecan grove that's in the big river bend in the Missouri River. That site is largely off limits to the public. And it is one of the most tremendous wild places in Kansas. And so there, I think it's an open book. How do we develop a way for people to experience this iconic forest while still, still keeping in mind the fact it's on a military reservation. And it's a very complicated topic. And I think we see those kinds of things in Kansas more than other places.
What is complicated about that?
Granting access to the public. Because right now, it's largely only military people that go to that site, largely hunters that go there. But there's an increasing demand. And I know because people who've read my book will always ask me, how do we go into the ancient pecan grove on Fort Leavenworth? It's not advertised publicly, but people are finding out about it through my book, through other
ways. Do you
think
that's good for the pecan grove, though, perhaps?
I think it's good.
We can't just go there?
I think it's good for the pecan grove. I think most of the wild places in Kansas benefit from visibility. Yeah.
Let's talk now with someone on the Missouri side. We've talked a lot about Kansas, and I read an article recently about glamping opportunities in Missouri. That is camping, but with more glamour. And it was in an article put out by the Missouri Tourism Office. The director of that office joins us now, Ward Franz. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What is glamping?
Oh, well, it's right in the name. Glamorous camping it's become more and more popular recently, I would say, in the last 3 to 5 years. I mean, it lets you get out and enjoy the beautiful outdoors, even if you don't have camping equipment and don't want the hassle of setting up a tent. But you still get to experience nature with the comforts of home.
Can you give an example of a glamping opportunity in Missouri?
Well, we have a number around the state. We have 3 state parks that offer glamping. That would be Lake of the Ozarks State Park, Table Rock Lake State Park, and Palme de Terre. And then we have some more private companies. There's Holly Farm Glamping in the Kansas City area, Glamping St. Louis, which is down in the River Island Marina, just minutes from St. Louis. You got the Magic Tippy Retreat located in Park Hills. And then in Branson, you have Camp Long Creek, which was opened by Big Cedar Lodge in Branson, that offers luxury tents with king-size canopy beds and chandeliers. So there is something for everybody.
So, okay, on the one hand, this sounds amazing. Like, I really can have it all, you know? The other hand, if camping is a low-impact, it's kind of a model for a low impact way to experience the beauty of nature. You know, you're not going in and setting up the infrastructure for electricity. You're treading pretty lightly if you're camping traditionally. Glamping seems like it ratchets that impact right back up with TVs running on electricity, big bathtubs full of water. Granted, Under the Stars is a great place to take a bath. That sounds amazing. So then on the other hand, you're keeping travelers closer to home because I'm guessing people aren't coming to glamp in Missouri from like Florida. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it gives the opportunity for all ages, whether, let's say, you're a younger 20-something-year-old who wants to try something new that their parents never did. So that gives you an opportunity. It's a little more expensive than a regular traditional campsite, but it's cheaper than a hotel. But then, you know, when you get to be like my age and sleeping on a hard ground is not real comfortable, or a air-up mattress that runs out of air by the next morning, this is something that's very appealing to me.
Okay, so Martha, help us out here.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's really interesting to hear that there's glamping all over Kansas. Who would have thought?
Missouri, but go on.
Oh, Missouri, excuse me, Missouri. But glamping is certainly, I'm involved in a project where we're developing a master plan for part of Oman in the Middle East, and glamping is one of the things that we're proposing for there. I've seen it all over, you know, East and Southern Africa as well. And I think if it's done well, it can be done sustainably, so that basically when you pick up what you've put down for the campsite, there's really no footprint left. So it can be very much a responsible, sustainable type of tourism. And as your other guests said, it is certainly something easier for older people.
Well, our time is up, but everyone out there, happy travels this summer. Let us know what you're seeing out there and how you're making choices to tread lightly or not, or wrestling with these issues at all. We're at KCUR-CST, and we've spoken with Martha Honey from the Center for Responsible Travel, as well as George Fraser, Ward Franz, and Marcia Roselle. Up next, the story of a black cowboy. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm here with Trey QL Venerable. He's writing children's books about black cowboys. They are about his own family's story. Trey Venerable, good morning.
Hey, how are we doing?
Good. You are working on what, your third book right now?
Yes, ma'am. Yep. The third book is hoping for it to come out in July or August.
The whole series is called Grandpa, I Just Want to Be a Cowboy. Where does that line come from?
Well, so when I was younger, I always wanted to be a cowboy. I thought it was like really cool. And then when the idea got birthed into me to write this book series, it was just cool. I was talking to my dad about it, and I was like, Dad, I just want to be a cowboy. But then it turned to Grandpa, I just want to be a cowboy. So
you are a fourth generation cowboy, as I understand it.
Yes. Yes, ma'am. Yep. So every generation of my family on both sides has owned a ranch or a farm.
What are the stories that have been passed down to you about the people in your family who have been cowboys?
A lot of stories.
Tell a couple of favorites.
Yeah, a lot of stories. The strong sense of pride in our family, the community that's built, the legacy that I'm standing on today, down in southern Missouri and on the Kansas side. Yeah, it's been really cool with the horses and the hunting dogs and Grandpa going out there and stuff. So yeah, it's been fun.
And this is... Your relatives have been on both of African-American heritage and Native American heritage.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
That is not typically what you see in an old Western as the cowboy character.
Yeah.
You may have noticed.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, so my family, we're considered mulattoes, so mixed descent. So we have African-American heritage and Native American heritage. So we traced it back. We have three tribes in the family: Choctaw, Cherokee, and Blackfoot Indian.
And what do you see as the legacy in the sort of cowboy world that is not necessarily visible in a Western, but that might have been part of the real story and needs to be understood as part of the real story?
Yeah, so and especially with this series, one of the main things that I say is I'm telling the unforgettable cowboy story. And so the forgotten cowboy story. And so, you know, back in those days, 1 to 3, 1 to 4 were of African American descent, and the mulatto, so some mixed descent. And yeah, I just feel like I need to tell that story. It was really pressing.
There's been a controversy around a song, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I knew this was coming up.
You know, this. Some people are saying that this song isn't country enough. It's got a black cowboy character, and it's kind of a reminder that there is this divide between history and mythology in our pop culture.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, the Old Town Road. So I like that he's bringing enlightenment to the community, but I wish he would have hit more on like cowboy things and cowboy stories. And it's cool that the story is being talked about, but it's not like the full story. Kind of, it's almost kind of like a joke in a sense. And
do you mean it's almost kind of like a joke?
Well, because like with my books, I'm highlighting the culture and I'm going out and, you know, teaching kids about horses and ranching and things of that nature. And I don't feel like the song's really edifying anybody, really. That's just like my personal vendetta on it. But yeah, I don't feel like he's really edifying through it. Now, I'm not mad about the song or anything, but you know, through my talks and the books, I'm edifying the next generation, but really the now generation. So
you're when you talk about your talks, you're on something that you're calling the Cowpoke Tour. Where are you going and who are you talking to? What's the whole idea there?
Yeah, so Cowpoke's nowhere from the West meaning cowboy. So I started a clothing gig back in school called Midwest Cowpoke. And so it's kind of all my projects. So I have a business called Venerable Projects LLC, and it's just kind of like my fun stuff that I do. But the 2019 Cowpoke Book Tour, gone to about 25 schools, worked with a lot of non-for-profit partners. I love giving back. That's my heart. My heart is for children's literacy, so.
And what you're talking to kids about cowboys as part of that?
Yes. I'm talking to kids about cowboying, you know, so well, I'll bring old saddles, cow skulls, you name it, lasso, stuff like that. But also the talk is way more than that. It's about letting them see themselves on that stage and letting them see that.
Seeing you on that stage?
By seeing me on that stage. Because when I was younger, I didn't see black authors coming into schools reading. And so I've talked to crowds from 10 kids all the way up to about 400, 450. And so it's been a really cool, humbling process. And kids come up to me and say, you know, I have a story inside of me. I'm like, yeah, you sure do. You know, go write it. Go tell the world your story. So
has a kid actually told you the story that they want to put in a book?
Yeah.
Tell me one of the kids' stories.
I don't know. It was really personal.
Oh, okay.
It was really personal. But
do you think that the kid's going to tell it now?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so the kid from that school writes in their diary already, and he felt the need, the urge to tell me about the story, and I was like, wow, that's really cool. So, yeah.
So part of when you go around talking about cowboying, as I didn't quite know that was a verb, but I know now.
Yeah,
and I've been reading in your books, one of them about some of the famous black cowboys shares like cowboy moves that some of these guys invented. Yeah. And one of them is bulldogging.
Bulldogging, Bill Pickett.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, so he invented the rodeo technique that we call today, well, steer wrestling, but bulldogging.
What is it?
So it's a cowboy on a horse, and then he has his hazer on the other side, and we're talking about in a rodeo setting now.
Excuse me, but what is a hazer? I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So a hazer keeps the steer running straight for the cowboy to have the best attempt to wrestle down the steer and get the best time.
And so, and bulldogging.
So back to bulldogging. So bulldogging, the mounted cowboy gets off his horse, grabs the steer by his horns, and then he throws him down with his force, and yeah. And then the steer, for time to be over, the steer must hit his back and all four legs in the air for the most part. So.
And so the guy who invented this, Bill Pickett, his story?
Yeah, so Bill Pickett, he was a cool guy. So for my research, he was a mulatto, so black and Indian. And yeah, they have it on film too, and him going around, and he was throwing a big steer around. And so like with cowboying, especially in the book, I used a lot of quick talk and fast slang and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it was a really fun project.
Okay. there's another word in here, and I've picked words that I just like the words.
Okay.
Hula handling?
Yeah, hula handing. I knew that was coming.
Hula handing.
So Jesse Stahl, yeah.
Tell us about him, and then tell us what hula handing is.
Yeah, so Jesse Stahl, he was a big-time cowboy back in the day, and he was a big rodeo cowboy, but then a rancher too, and hula handing was his rodeo technique. And so, it was the research on it, like, let's see, I can read a little bit about it.
Your book is coming in handy right now.
Yeah, it is, because I have a lot of things going in my head right now.
You know, while you're looking that up, I know I don't mean to distract you from your search for the story of hula handing, but
yeah.
You've used a word a couple of times to describe yourself and a couple of other cowboys you've written about.
Mm-hmm.
The word mulatto, which is sort of a controversial term or just carries a lot of baggage for some people. And I'm curious about what it is that you identify with the term. It seems to be the term of choice for you.
Yeah, so I feel like with the books, it's a lot of stuff is controversial about just about everything in there. And with mulatto, I guess I take precedent with it is because my ancestors went through it. So I want to feel the same kind of fight that they did. And especially through the stories of the cowboys that I wrote through, I mean, they went through just about everything. And their fight for equality, their fight for just to be considered a man. I just kind of want to resonate with how they resonated. So
it feels like it connects you to the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a way that where you're going to keep fighting a fight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself a cowboy?
Yes. So there's a lot of different cowboys. So there's an article going around about, it's called the City Cowboy. And so my dad does call me a City Cowboy, and shout out to my dad because it's his birthday today. He's 62.
Aww.
So I love you, guy. And I am a cowboy. You have, you know, rodeo cowboys. You have ranchers. You have a wide array of cowboys. But, I mean, the technical definition of a cowboy is just somebody who takes care of cows and tends to the horses and things of that nature. So, yeah, from that definition, yeah, I am a cowboy.
Tell me about your horses and cows and such.
Yeah, so our family runs a decent-sized herd down in southern Missouri. And then I'm a horseman, so we race Tennessee walking horses. And I like to rope and other things of that nature, cowboying task. And then I'm a houndsman. We raise coon hounds and mountain curs, things of that nature. We also have labs too, so we're a big hunting family too.
And so when you go into schools and talk to kids about this, do you find that kids seem to take more interest in the whole, man, this is a writer, I could tell my own story someday piece, or man, this is a real live cowboy?
A little bit of both. Like, I don't even get caught up in that I'm like a cowboy per se, you know. I just—
You have on no hat.
Yeah, like I have no, like, so I have boots on right now. I have ostrich boots on, but yeah, I don't like really get caught up in the whole look. I have some best friends from like down in Oklahoma, and like, for instance, Lane Reeves, he's a big roper, and this guy wears like buckle, like nothing but buckle. But you get him on a horse though, and it's a totally different story. And it like really opened my eyes to like, you don't have to— You like your closet doesn't represent like what you are, you know, like what you do represents what you are. I remember Grandpa saying like, you don't have to tell people what you are, you know, like they like it should just show.
You just have to do it.
Yeah, it should just show through your actions, you know. So yeah, like this is kind of funny. I would like consider myself like the country Kanye West, you know, because like I could have like, you know, some tight Wranglers on, but then with like some Yeezys and stuff like that. So I mean, it just, you know, you never know with me. So
I have spoken with some cowboy musicians on this show before, and they seemed very committed to the idea that country and Western are not the same thing.
Country and Western are not the same thing.
Maybe that's just for music.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't really get into music. I mean, I like I will say, I don't necessarily like the new country now. It's more pop, and most of those guys are talking about things they've never done in their life. I do like the older country, like Charlie Pride, like Kissing Angel Good Morning. And let her know you're thinking about her when she's gone. But yeah, so like Charlie Pride and guys like that. But I don't really get with the new country at all.
So can we return to hula handing?
Yeah, hula handing. So I don't really describe it, but it is a rodeo technique. And so Jesse Stahl was known for his riding skills. And so there's a difference between, there's saddle bronc riding and then bareback bronc riding. And so it's just the technique that he invented.
Yeah. What do we need to know about Jesse Stahl other than that he invented something that's really fun to say called hula handing?
Yeah. That he fought for his time in history, and his story is getting told. And one thing I do want to say through my nonprofit reach and everything is that I've had some really good partners, Lee Tareed for one, and then one thing is I See Me. We have a future collab coming out for some representation book fairs, so be looking out for that.
Well, Trey QL Venerable, author of The Grandpa I Just Want to Be a Cowboy books, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Trey is on his cowpoke tour right now, and he's working on his third children's book in the series. That's a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to either of these conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Or if you've missed anything in recent shows, you can find them all there. kcur.org/centralstandard. And talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.